This week in Retronauts, we're your favorite wingmen, we're watching your sixes. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode, hey, whatever episode it is, I forgot to look it up. Oh, 742. Is that right? Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, it's some episode. It has a lot of digits. It's really cool. And we're talking about things in the past. I know that's blowing your mind, Retronauts, talking about things in the past, but it's got to happen this week. And you know, we're talking about a past where, as we mentioned before the podcast began, food standards were good and COVID didn't exist. And that's why we are a power trio this week. We were going to be a power quintet, but, Chris Sims has food poisoning because of the FDA's collapse, I'm assuming. And, Binge Edwards sadly has COVID. So, they had to drop out and we're hoping for them to have a speedy recovery as we enter the new year. But those of us who are well enough to record are still here talking about old things, specifically the year 1996. That was 30 years ago. Moment of silence for our youth. All right. So who else is with me here? Oh, I should introduce myself. Let's keep it era appropriate. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and I'm here to say I love podcasting in a major way. All right, who else do I have with me here? Up in Crabtown. Up in Oystertown.
Okay, I'm guessing that's me. Hi, everybody. I'm Jared Petty. I'm here in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, Canada. I host the Top 100 Games podcast, just in case you're into that kind of nonsense. And besides that, I occasionally work for Jeremy on and off. For some reason, he chooses to employ me sometimes, so I love that.
And also up there, down there, in between, in the aforementioned town of Crabs.
Yeah, it's Kevin Bunch, who is currently 30% Christmas ham by volume.
Wow, that's a lot of ham. you're also a very slight man, so I guess it doesn't take much.
When I think of Crabtown, I'm thinking Baltimore. Am I in the wrong place?
That's about right.
He's adjacent.
You know, Central Maryland, very like crab-centric.
Yeah.
I guess the Eastern Shore, too.
You're like a 20-minute drive from Baltimore.
Somewhere around there. Depends on traffic.
I've done the drive myself. I know. That was Towson, but I mean, that's Baltimore.
It's close enough.
Yeah, it counts.
All right. So anyway, we have talked about 1976 briefly, 1986. I was on an episode with Bob talking about 2006, and now we've got to fill in the gaps. Yes, this is a years in review where we talk about the games and game related things of a year, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in the past. I guess not 10, just 20, 30, 40, 50. And so now we're, you know, kind of circling in on the middle, the coolest year, maybe. I don't know. 1996, certainly lots of things were happening. We're not going to talk too much about the year itself. There were some Olympics. That was, you know, there were probably Olympics games that tied in with that. I do know that Nintendo almost released a 32-bit portable handheld system called Atlantis because the Olympics were in Atlantis. Atlantis. The amazing Olympics. Yes, they were in Atlanta, Georgia that year. And so the game system that was abortive and never came to fruition was codenamed Project Atlantis. So that's your video game trivia. Thanks, everyone. We're out. What were you guys doing in the year 1996?
I was spending a lot of time walking around in a stupid leather jacket, trying to get girls to kiss me at various levels of success. I think that was mostly my focus in life that year. It's just a truly stupid looking jacket and a lot a lot of tongue play. That was really 1996. Also some video games in there that we'll talk about in a moment. A lot of sweet tea. And yeah.
So you were in North Carolina at the time?
Yeah, I was in North Carolina at the time. Mm-hmm. Getting ready to go to college the next year and filling out a lot of college applications for schools I was mostly interested in terms of how cute the girls were when I got there. And that was kind of life. Hanging out of a pharmacy window, climbing into people's cars at the drive-thru occasionally as part of my job.
This was about 1996, not 1956.
Yeah, it was 1996. Hickory was a weird town. I got my last great high school job was working at like this old-style pharmacy with a functioning lunch counter and a post office.
We have one of those here in Raleigh still. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my job was, as a kid, it was great because I had like seven jobs and you never got bored there. It was a lot of fun. Every year at Christmas, he'd go have me come out and cook the Christmas spread. That was like part of my job and I just loved it.
Yeah, we had one of those old fashioned soda fountain type pharmacies in the town where I went to college too. And, you know, you'd go and when they made a Coke float for you or a soft drink or even, they like scooped the syrup with a spoon and then stirred it in with seltzer. It was
I have done that.
Vanished time. Yep. All right.
A lost art.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what about you?
I was in middle school, so I'm trying to rack my brain on exactly what was going on in 96 on my end. I had absolutely zero games, so that there was nothing with girls happening at all. I remember playing a fair bit of games with my friends at the time, because, you know, what else was a bunch of middle school kids with nothing else happening going on? And I seem to recall I was taking in a lot of Star Trek, because that was when, like, they were doing their 30th anniversary, like, re-airings of the shows, like, without all the syndication cuts. Hmm. So I remember sitting in and watching those a lot. And, you know, just generally bumming around the library, because the library had internet access.
Nice.
So I got.
I remember that period with Star Trek you're talking about, Kevin, because that was the first time I saw most of those episodes without the syndication cuts. I didn't even know they were there, and I was like, "Why are they so long? What have I been missing? Oh God!" Like,
yeah, they were like 90-minute blocks or something absurd.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I started going out, and this is actually a bit again collecting Star Trek physical media right around this time.
Yeah, this is really when I started like getting into Star Trek a lot more, so that colors a lot of my memories of the time.
Yeah, let's see. As for myself, because I'm the old man here, I was already in college, and actually, this was a pretty pivotal year for me personally. For whatever reason, the administration at our university's journalism department said, "Hey, guy who is not a journalism major, but who contributes to our newspaper, we want you to be the EIC this year, but you haven't taken enough classes. So we're going to give you a scholarship to go study for a summer semester in Prague. You have to pay for your flight there, but you've got the rest." It was I don't know how that happened exactly. I was very fortunate. So I got to really like leave the country for the first time and see the world beyond. And then I came back and became EIC of our tiny student newspaper. So that was kind of cool.
What was Prague like circa 1996, Jeremy?
Man, you know, I haven't been back since then, so I can't speak to what Prague is like now. But in 1996, they were just sort of coming out of the haze of the Soviet Union and, you know, the long spring beginning and what was his name? Vaclav becoming president and, you know, basically just breaking away from the Soviet Union and figuring out what do we do next. And it was really interesting because there was a lot of Soviet era infrastructure, like half the buildings were just brutalist structures that rose to the sky. There was a subway that we would take from the university where we were studying into the central Prague area. And it ran, but pretty much every trip, you'd get into the tunnel and about halfway through and it would just stop and the lights would go out and you'd sit there in darkness for a couple of minutes while they figured it out again and you'd get up and running and, you know, there might have been another stop or two along the way, but you would eventually get into the city. There were shop displays at, I guess, you know, their equivalent of department stores that were just showcasing interesting new imports like deodorant and shampoo. Like, you know, here are Western brands. You'd get on the subway and people would be taking home a Little Caesars pizza and kind of, you know, just there was this real sense of like, this is all new and exciting and we're still figuring it out, but we're curious to go. But, you know, everyone there was very friendly. There, it was kind of barely above, I would say, the poverty line at that point for the standard of living. But there was, yeah, just a good-hearted sense about the place. And, you know, we would spend a lot of time in the city at a bookstore called The Globe, which was Western oriented, and I believe Americans had established it and ran it. And so there was a mix of like European and American books in there. And I discovered my first internet cafe and would drink this amazing flavorful fruit tea while trying desperately to send an email back to my parents at like, you know, 1 kilobit per second or something like that. It was just terrible, but it was interesting. So yeah, it's hard for me to characterize what Prague was like then versus now, but I'm sure now it's very commercialized, very built up, very modern. At the time it was not, and there was just so much beautiful architecture, you know, the bridges and the churches and everything. I came back home and I saw Mission Impossible and I was like, oh my God, I know all these places. I was there. There was no giant aquarium to explode. Ethan Hunt must have already detonated that place. Anyway, yeah, it was great.
Freaking great, Jeremy. That's wonderful. I didn't know about that part of your life.
It was a beautiful experience. But, you know, just traveling abroad in places where I didn't know the language, I was studying graphic design at the time instead of journalism, and it really opened my eyes to the importance of visual language as opposed to written language and iconography and things like that. So it was, yeah, it was great. This is all super irrelevant, but it does kind of speak to, I think, the state of the changing world at the time, where there was this sense of optimism and this sense of like, the Cold War is over. Everyone's friends now. Everything's going to be great. You know, of course, that was stupid and wrongheaded, but you could understand why we felt that way. You know, meanwhile, the first news story, major news story for 1996 in the U.S. was a government shutdown as Newt Gingrich tried to, you know, push a rebellion in Congress against Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton pushed back, and that was the longest shutdown that America had seen in the government until more recently. So, you know, the seeds of the bad future were already there. We just didn't all necessarily know to recognize them because we were so dazzled by the internet and the future and the advent of the new console race, new technology and video games. I mean, video games were so awesome now. How could the future not be amazing? That's what I ask you, and that's where we are headed this episode. So, as with the previous episode that we recorded, I'm taking a different approach to the years in review, and basically just asking everyone to isolate a few notable items for the year 1996 in video gaming for themselves, not necessarily the biggest things, although certainly we're going to talk about those, but also the things that were most meaningful to us. So I think, you know, since we're just focusing on a single year, and also there are just three of us, we can afford to, I would say, downshift into second gear and kind of take our time, you know, cruise down the road and enjoy the wind in our hair, the delicious smells of 1996 blooming in the distance. We've each identified six items. Chris was not able to put in his items before he got sick. Binge did, so we'll kind of touch on Binge's things, although we can't bring his personal perspective into stuff. But we can certainly talk about the things that we do know and care about. So I'm going to kick things off because I feel like my first item is one that is kind of an umbrella that's going to encompass a lot of other things, and you guys are welcome to chime in and contribute to this conversation.
It's kind of a big one here, ain't it? Goodness.
Yeah, like this is the bullet point equivalent of going to a Q&A session and asking a question that's like five parts. Shut up and leave some space for everyone else. But no, I'm that guy standing at the microphone and everyone's like, "Oh my God." And the person answering the questions is like, not one of these. But that's me. So the big thing I would say 1996 in gaming is that it's just a sea change. You know, I was talking about the changing tides of politics and Cold War and the advent of capitalism in former communist countries and things like that. We were seeing big changes in the gaming space and just in computing as 3D acceleration became accessible, cheap, sort of like a standard component in computers, and also became a core component of video games, of consoles. The big consoles for 1996 were really the PlayStation, Saturn, N64, Game Boy. Three of those had been around for a while by that point. PlayStation launched September 95 in the US, December 94 in Japan. Saturn launched around the same time in Japan as PlayStation and summer 95 in America. But, you know, they took a little while to get traction. They did pretty well their first holiday season. But I feel like it was fall 1996 where people really, you know, they started to really get that momentum. They started to snowball and pick up a lot of games, a lot of customers, a lot of excitement and hype. And it wasn't just magazines saying, "Wow, Triangle People." It was actually people going to the store, playing demos, saying, "Wow, Triangle People," and then buying those Triangle People to play at home. And, you know, Nintendo entered the race in August, September, with the Nintendo 64, which brought their own Triangle People. But these were different. They were fuzzy Triangle People, very blurry Triangle People. So
yeah.
Everyone kind of had their own thing going on. But the point is, a new generation of video gaming had really begun. And you saw that reflected in the nature of games that started shipping, in the nature of media coverage, and just in general, the way people responded to games. There was a real push, a real interest in moving away from 2D gaming, from sprites and bitmaps and things that didn't feel like immersive 3D, because the future was here. And those Triangle People looked a little silly, but they did open up a new dimension of interactive experiences. And we weren't quite into virtual reality yet, but, you know, Jurassic Park had been in theaters and was big. Toy Story had been in theaters and was big. And everyone was saying, these video game systems will let you experience Jurassic Park and Toy Story graphics in real time, which was a lie. But nevertheless, it was close enough that we said, oh yeah, I want some of that. And so,
yeah, I mean, you were talking about those store kiosks earlier, man, walking in and seeing Mario 64. Show us the way. Show us the way. What do we do with all this 3D technology? Oh, that's what. Okay.
I remember that and Panzer Dragoon in the kiosk for the Saturn and Knights eventually, that they just looked ridiculously good at the time. Not so much now, but at the time, you know.
You know, I want to say that the Toys R Us near me put Rayman on for its Saturn kiosk, which, like, yeah, the Saturn was a monster for 2D gaming, but it was next to Wipeout. Like, who's gonna look at Rayman and then look at Wipeout in 1996 and say, you know what, I want that weird little guy with no arms. That just seems like the future of gaming to me. No, it was the crazy fast techno music spaceship blast 'em up racing game. You looked at that and were like, wow, this is like a crazy arcade game, but it's on a 14-inch TV. I could own this at home for $300. This is nuts. You know, that Mario 64, yeah, there was also Red Alarm on a kiosk. That was a bad idea. Just Virtual Boy. But yeah, those kiosks really had a big impact. I will say, though, that the changing nature of games, 3D games are more complex. They sometimes showcase really well. Mario 64, Nintendo was genius to give you the play space outside the castle when you first start the game. That's just this open, threat-free space where people could say, wow, I'm moving around in a cartoon and everything is around me and moving and I can do whatever. I can look behind the castle and I can see what's there. You know, a few months later, they put Shadows of the Empire out on kiosks, and I was really excited about it. I mean, this was, you know, the time of the Star Wars revival. Star Trek, yes, but also Star Wars. We're building up to the prequel trilogy by way of the remastered special edition original trilogy, by way of Shadows of the Empire, the multimedia sensation featuring Prince Xizor.
That's right. Rendar.
Dash Rendar and Prince Xizor. They were the future of video gaming in Star Wars. And I played that Shadows of the Empire demo and said, I do not want this video game. I am not going to buy this. This is god awful. If I want to play a first person shooter, I'm going to just go back and play some more Dark Forces on my Mac. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you had done that, right? You had played Dark Forces. Yeah. You already knew what you were missing.
So in a weird twist of stupidity, the weird porting nature of PC to Mac, that pipeline, meant that LucasArts was really on top of Macs. So Dark Forces came to Mac before the Doom games. So, nice. You know, there was Dark Forces and there was Marathon. But, I mean, the first-person shooting segments of Dark Forces were several magnitudes of order, or several orders of magnitude, better than the third-person shooting segments of Shadows of the Empire. And it was really hard to look at that grimy, awful sewer stage in Shadows of the Empire and think, you know what? This is what I want from my Star Wars. I mean, I didn't really like the sewer stage in Dark Forces, but at least you were like blowing up Gamorrean guard to go... Well, I can't make that noise. But anyway, they'd make their little piggy noises and die.
You'd find an Ewok in a wall if you hunted hard enough. Things like that.
I think that was in a... Wasn't that in a base, though? That was like Nar Shaddaa.
Yeah, he was not in the sewer.
I know. I know the name Nar Shaddaa. What's wrong with me? Go ahead, Kevin.
I was going to say, this was like, I don't know, a year or so after I discovered Star Wars in general. So I almost did add Shadows of the Empire to my list. Like, oh... I don't actually want to talk that much about that game because it sucked ass, but it was everywhere. They were really pushing that one hard.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you take something like Shadows of the Empire, and I appreciate a lot of what they were trying to do. You feel like it's just unrefined. That game feels like it was pushed out the door a little soon, in my opinion. But you see some neat ideas there, things that would get played on, you know, very quickly in stuff like Jedi Knight. If you compare like the level design in Shadows, where it's all just pushing you down narrow, grimy corridors, versus Jedi Knight, where like you're rolling down the side of a mountain inside a collapsing spaceship, but you know things are sliding around, and it's like how did one idea get lost? But I do try to remember that one was designed for $3,000 computers, and one was designed for a $300 piece of brand new hardware that they barely gotten their heads around.
So you know, I played Dark Forces on my $1,500 Mac all-in-one device that was a disaster. So
yeah, I'm talking about Jedi Knight, my friend. Year with that. I mean, those level designs, Jedi Knight, are really cool. You had that a couple of really innovative stages, and you can just tell it's left-hand, right-hand stuff with the studios working on it. But yeah, Shadows was all. All hype, no substance, except for that Hoth level, I think. And I guess we all just remember that 5 minutes and move on, but it's not a fun game. And by the time you're fighting Boba Fett, I just want to throw the controller down or through the screen. It's downright frustrating there, that last third.
But Hoth was great, right, everybody? Hoth?
Yeah. You liked it on Atari 2600. Now look how cool it is 15 years later.
I do remember somehow figuring out, like, a spot on the geometry of the Hoth level where you could, like, break out of the barrier that's supposed to keep you in the arena. And it makes these really weird, like, visual effects that my friends and I thought were a lot more fun than the actual game. So,
maybe the problem with Shadows was Teemu Han Solo versus Teemu Jabba the Hutt. You know, that at that deep a level, that's the problem. Is you just really are just deliberately second tiering your pro and antagonists, and that does take something away from it.
Yeah, it was kind of their test balloon to see, like, are Star Wars fans rabid enough to buy anything that says Star Wars? And the answer was yes, and so here we are.
And around the same time they came out with the game, there's this Kyle Katarn guy, and they're like, hey, you used to be a spy, now you're a Jedi, and you fight 7 evil Jedi. Which game would you rather play? And I was like, I want to fight the game where I fight the 7 evil Jedi, please, with a lightsaber.
Yeah, so anyway, we kind of got sidetracked into Shadows of the Empire there. But, you know, it does kind of, I feel, embody just kind of the essence of this era, where the idea of doing everything that you had done before in video games, but now in immersive 3D, was very compelling, but not necessarily that fun.
Yeah, it's so damn of the time, though. I mean, it made sense. Well, we're going to take... going to take Mega Man, and now he's going to do Mega Man things, and we're going to take Mario, he's going to do Mario things, we're going to take Star Wars, he's going to do Star Wars things, but they're all in 3D, and that's going to be fun.
Yeah, but you know, the thing about Mega Man is when he moved into 3D, he really didn't do Mega Man stuff, and that's why people were angry.
That's a good
point. So, yeah, it was like, there were a lot of struggles in that era, but, you know, the 3D generation would find its footing, I would say, really, in 1997. Like, to me, that is the year where PlayStation really took off and became like, hey, you liked NES and Super NES and Genesis? Well, here's where all those, like, evolved game experiences ended up. Nintendo and Sega are kind of off lost in the woods somewhere. They don't really know what they're doing, but over here on PlayStation, everyone is doing cool stuff, and the games are less expensive, so if you buy something that you hate, it's okay because it's not going to break the bank the way, like, a big Super NES game would, or a big N64 game. So, you know, 1996, they were still sort of figuring all of that out. Just like in Prague, you know, really. They were kind of finding their way and a little tentative, but there was a sense of hope and optimism and promise. Meanwhile, there was Game Boy. Game Boy was still Game Boy. Binge did put Game Boy Pocket ? In his, Game Boy Pocket maybe? No, that happened that year. And that was kind of the final hurrah for Gunpei Yokoi at Nintendo. Virtual Boy didn't work out the way he had hoped, so he decided it's time to retire, but I do want to give, you know, one last little point of brightness on my resume, my legacy. And so he made, you know, led the design of the Game Boy Pocket, which had a smaller physical form. It had a crisper, clearer, ghosting-free LCD screen that was slightly larger and actually monochrome gray as opposed to whatever that color was on the original Game Boy. It was just kind of the realization of Game Boy, what it should have been. And it happened to coincide with the Japanese release of Pokemon, which no one really thought anything about. Like, the Pocket was really supposed to be sort of the farewell Game Boy, we're out, time for the next-gen stuff. But then Pokemon was so big, and that launched in February 96. We'll probably talk about that later. It was so big that it just revitalized the Game Boy in general. And all of a sudden, that Project Atlantis thing, which was not quite ready for prime time, got put on the back burner and retooled into an ARM-based system called Game Boy Advance 5 years later. You know, the Game Boy Pocket did evolve into the color, but it became kind of the lifeline for Nintendo as it struggled with the N64. So as much as the future of gaming and 3D was so exciting, and the way that everything was, the direction everything was heading, really, you know, if it weren't for that very, very old technology of the Game Boy and the fact that it was cheap as chips and anyone could buy a $20 or $30 game and anyone could make a game for that system, I don't know if there would still be Nintendo around, but they owe it all to Pikachu.
This is the year for my little brother. I have a much younger brother, and he's a person with autism. And this is the year that suspicion was confirmed for me. As my brother broke into Pokemon like nothing I'd ever seen him take an interest in. The extraordinary, inscrutable, deep, interconnected mathematical nature of the thing, the artwork of the creatures drew him in like nothing I'd ever seen in my entire life. He was happier than I ever saw him playing and trading Pokemon. And begging to be driven to the mall to hang outside a store on a Saturday with a cable, hoping another kid would walk by so they could, and they would come. They would come in masses. And, you know, at that point, our popular understanding of autism, Asperger's syndrome, things like that were still very, very, underdeveloped as a country. But that was actually kind of an important year for coming to understand who my brother was as a person. And Pokemon was the catalyst. It helped me. I was like, you know, I kind of think I get some of this now. Okay. They were going to tell me about it, Drew. And off it went. So that was quite a year for video games in our house, certainly. He's still at 40. He's playing just as much Pokemon as he ever did. And he loves it to death. It's really important to him.
What are his thoughts on Eevee and Ivy training?
I mean, he knows the charts by memory. I know that. And digs in and does Jeep. Like, he's a big fan of, like, Pokemon eugenics. He'll go in he'll manipulate the deep numbers. Yeah, he goes into the dark recesses and tries to create truly optimized Pokemon just because doing so makes him happy. Knowing they exist on his cartridge pleases him. and
fair
so
enough.
He will sometimes farm for days, weeks to try to create an absolutely perfect Ivy Eevee Pokemon for that particular breed and build. Do that. Yeah. He will play without them, but he tells me that he knows it's not perfect, so he has to go back and fix it.
That's interesting. You know, I guess we could just talk about Pokemon now. One of the things that I think makes that game so successful is that it can appeal to people on so many different levels. You have the people who are just like, you know, writing spreadsheets and trying to create the most perfect Pokemon imaginable for combat purposes, creating the ultimate team. You have people who are just like, I like the way this funny little guy looks. I want a bunch of him on my team. There's people who kind of are in between and just enjoy it as an RPG, as a chance to collect everything, to, you know, see a number get bigger. And, you know, I have some nephews who are, you know, now in their early 20s, but they grew up playing Pokemon, and they continue going back to play like the DS games over and over again, not because they want to master them or become the ultimate combat warriors in the Pokemon space. Like, they'll do off-brand Pokemon online game battles and stuff, but they don't really compete that much in the game. It's just like it's just their comfort space. They just go back and replay those games over and over again. And you know, every interpretation there is valid. And Pokemon is one of the few games that can really sustain that, like, super superficial experience or unbelievably deep experience. Like, it rewards all of those things. So, you know, you can see why it became so successful. And it certainly, no one expected it to be that kind of success, but Nintendo certainly didn't waste any time once they realized, oh, we've got a viral hit here. They jumped on it, and you know, within 2 years it was a global juggernaut. But it kind of started humbly on a system that no one really cared about except its designer, who was like, yeah, we're gonna make a budget version. That's fine.
Jeremy,
and that just happened to be perfect timing.
Back in 96, did you know the Game Boy was awesome? I know you've long been a advocate for handheld systems. Did you know back then that it's as nifty as you think it is now?
No, I thought it was pretty much a relic by like 1992 or so. And pretty much anytime I stumbled across Game Boy games at retail, I was like, oh, weird. You know, why are there Japanese games here in a game store at the mall in West Texas? Like, that's weird. It was just this like kind of dumping ground for random stuff. And I wasn't the market for it. It wasn't until Game Boy Color and really Neo Geo Pocket Color came out that I was like, oh, okay, here we go. And a big part of that was, going back to the original topic here, I wasn't ready to say goodbye to two-dimensional gaming. I wasn't ready to say goodbye to sprites and classic forms of games. And certainly those weren't anywhere to be found on N64. They were pretty scarce on PlayStation, especially good ones. And, you know, Saturn had pretty much dried up and gone nowhere at that point. And the really cool stuff wasn't making it to America anyway. So for me, like, portable systems were kind of the place to continue finding those experiences, even though they were downgraded and not nearly as visually interesting or sophisticated as what you saw in consoles. You know, it was still better than nothing. So that's kind of when I shifted my allegiance over there. It was a couple of years later.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Talking on Pokemon, like, yeah, when that came out in 1998 over here, I seem to recall it being pretty popular. I was in high school at the time, and I remember a lot of students messing with it. It's also when the University of Michigan in Dearborn started doing anime nights, or at least that's when I discovered they were doing anime nights, where they just have, like, a couple times a month, they would host viewings in one of the classrooms with a big screen, and then the next room over, like the lab room, people would bring their Game Boys and mostly Game Boy Pockets and trade and battle and all sorts of fun stuff, which is how I really discovered Pokemon. And it was a wild time, like the next few years, it was just everywhere that I could conceive of, really. And I assume it's still very big among small children. I guess I'll find out in a few years, huh?
You get there. It has to jockey for popularity among things like Roblox and Fortnite and Minecraft. There's a wider field, but Pokemon is still big, 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 big.
I'm gonna say, if there's a possibility to ban Roblox in this house, I'm taking it.
Do it.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo built theme parks for a reason, and they're just scratching the surface. Yeah. They're sitting on a Walt Disney level cast of characters between them and the Pokemon Company. And there's no way on earth we don't end up with some sort of like Pokelandia sooner or later that children are screaming to enter, that I am screaming to enter, because I don't really play Pokemon games, but God, I love those creature designs and enjoy that world. Just that weird universe. And yeah, I want to go like eat delicious.
Hang out with a life-size whale lord.
Yes, I want to hang out with a big lightning rat and eat ketchup. I'm going to go to an amusement park and do that. Absolutely. Even if I never play another game. And I'm looking forward to it too.
I want an animatronic. Oh, crap. I totally forgot the name. The Brontosaurus with the leaf wings and the bananas.
Oh, that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's like my favorite guy, and I can't remember his name because I don't really play. I want like an animatronic of those that actually has real bananas on its face that you can pluck and eat, and then you know they replace them so all the kids can have a banana. That'd just be great. Like
that's a great idea for it. So you should be an Imagineer.
I know Nintendo should hire me. I'm so cool.
I used to work with an Imagineer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, she was a real Imagineer. That would have been her job title before.
But she did not work at Imagineering, right?
Well, she did at Disney, yeah.
No. I mean the company, the game developer Imagineering.
No, she did not work there. No.
Okay.
No. She worked for other more prestigious Imagineering firm.
All right, so we've talked a lot about a lot of console stuff, but there is one console point of order that I think Kevin should address. It's item number 19 on your list, even though it's the first because Google Documents is really stupid. would you care to walk us through this one? Because it is the end of an era, in a way.
Yeah, and even Benj had this one on his list, so well, we're knocking two out with one go. So this was in 1996. This was the death of Atari Corporation, the split off from the unified Atari under Warner from that split in 1984 and ran for another 12 years under the Trammell family. 1996, this was the end of the line for it. It was sold and merged into JTS Corporation, which in turn later sold it to Hasbro Interactive, which through a series of events has led to the current form of Atari. There's some weird continuity there. But yeah, this is very, like, strange for me as someone who grew up with an Atari machine originally in the house. And, like, they were just always sort of around. They were a much smaller player at this point. No small part because Trammell was not good at running a video game business. Pretty good at a computer business, but not video games. And, they never really got off the ground very well with the Jaguar, their sort of centerpiece console at this point. So this was sort of the death of that. They put out a last few games, Defender 2000, which is like a Jeff Minter Defender game that's kind of okay. Attack of the Mutant Penguins, really weird, like, strategy sort of thing. And Fight for Life, which might be the worst fighting game on the Jaguar.
Is it worse than Kasumi Ninja?
It's slower than Kasumi Ninja.
Wow, because that has the reputation of being, like, the worst fighting game of the 90s.
So, like, well, Fight for Life is just boring. It's just just dull and awkward and nothing happens.
It has, like, this weird mechanic where, like, you beat someone and you take one of their special moves. And you can put in a code so that everybody has, like, a full roster of special moves, but that just means everyone plays like everyone else. I don't know, it's like a crappy version of Virtua Fighter is the best way I can put it, whereas Kasumi Ninja is like a crappy version of Mortal Kombat.
Ah.
In conclusion, you should play Ultra Vortech. But Atari Corp going down. Like, this was a weird one. Like, I know there was a real shakeout, a near crash in the game industry in the mid-90s, and it's really strange and surreal that Atari, you know, kind of surviving the first one and this bringing it down right here.
Didn't JTS make hard drives? Like,
they made hard drives.
That's what I thought. They got eaten by a hard drive maker. It's just so sad. It's like this,
it's
great
vertical integration.
Yeah, it's like whenever Sammy buys a great old Japanese studio, you just feel so warm and happy inside, you know? Mm-hmm. It's
Sega's done okay for itself, but
Sammy has surprised me in the last few years. I will give him that. Yeah.
You know, I remember the first Classic Gaming Expo I went to in, I think, 2004. One of the guests they got was one of the last people who worked at Atari Corporation. The guy who, like, turned off the lights when the company closed. And he had, like, a whole panel discussing that alongside, like, I think Al Alcorn talking about the start of Atari. It was interesting to have those two perspectives.
Did he play a pokey version of Closing Time as he did it?
He should have. You know, if they had brought, like props on stage, I like to think he would have.
Kevin, what was the last great Atari Games arcade game?
I'm trying to remember when Atari Games, like, got folded into Midway.
Okay.
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Rampart, maybe?
Rampart is pretty good. I know the Midway merger was in the 90s, and I do have, like, another game from that time frame on my list, but off the top of my head, I'm not sure. But they did, like, Atari Games was still very active in the late 90s.
Right, Rampart was great. We had a Rampart machine at Google I could never get away from. It was just too wonderful. What a great game.
You know, I played that for the first time this year and had a great time of it.
Yeah, did you? Did you have friends to play with, or just?
I did, and they kicked my butt at it. But
fine. What makes it for me is when you got two friends to play with. It's like a whole other game.
All right, I'm looking at a list of Atari games releases, and I'm going to say Rampart was the last great Atari games arcade creation.
Cool.
RIP Atari Games and Atari Corp. And there is one other game console that launched in 1996, if we should mention that. The Pippin Atmark, the misbegotten collaboration between Bandai, because they just, God, the more I learn about the history of Bandai consoles, the more I'm like, you guys really, you wanted this so bad and you had no idea how to do it. Terrible. But a collaboration between Bandai and Apple, and it was basically a power PC running on the low-cost, low-power 603E power PC chip. And, you know, all the Macs that ran on the 603E were awful, and so was the Pippin Atmark. So it had more traction in Japan than it did here, thanks to Bandai actually kind of pushing it and not really doing that here, and Apple not really giving a damn because they were undergoing tumult at the time. This was the middle of, big shakeouts, lots of uncertainty around Apple's future. Gil Amelio took over, and there was talk about switching the operating system to BOS and doing all kinds of stupid things that would have been disastrous. And then Steve Jobs like led a coup from the desert and took over as the interim CEO, or ICEO as he called himself, and turned it around a couple of years later with the iMac and then the iPod. But at the time, Apple was in a bad, bad way. Like, they were having their asses kicked at their own platform by licensed clone manufacturers. So, you know, they just had no idea what they were doing. And the Pippin Atmark was part of that. Terrible. But it did exist. It was a new console that did nothing. I think it sold a few tens of thousands of units worldwide. Just an absolute shit show disaster. However, it did give us some games by Masaya Matsuura. And Bungie technically published its first console game on Pippin in the form of Marathon, a port of Marathon 1 and 2. So there you go. Super Marathon is what it's called.
Which I've heard is very good.
That's that prequel to that new extraction shooter everybody's so excited about, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
And this one had all original art.
I'll be honest, I'm shocked Bandai has, when they bought Namco, did not immediately pivot them to putting out a console that would have sold 5 copies.
Yeah.
You know, I think the defeat of the Wonder Swan is when Bandai finally just said, there's no future for us in hardware. It took them 20 years to come, more than 20 years to come to that conclusion, but actually like 25 years. Wow. So they really were determined, but I think that might be why they merged with Namco. They were like, we're not going to make it in hardware, so we just need to find a company that makes really good-ass video games and dominate on software. And that was really, I would say, the correct strategy.
Yeah.
Seems to have worked out for
They strike me in the same sense as Sammy. It's like, oh boy, a much worse company bought a much better company, and, well, if they're still doing good stuff, it's against the tide.
My understanding, my impression is that Bandai doesn't really interfere with the Namco side of things, that they're just like, we have a lot of properties and we are making a lot of money off of Namco games, but Namco, just do your thing. Make more Tekkens and whatevers. And it seems to be working okay for them. Anyway, so that's the console side of things. We should talk about the PC side of things, because this was really when PC gaming became a thing, as opposed to like, oh, well, we have a computer and my parents won't let me own a console, so I'm going to play a really bad game that's nowhere near as fun as Mario. You know, the mid-90s is when the personal computer became, I would say, universally like a platform that people gravitated to and preferred over consoles, because you were getting the same 3D experiences as on consoles, but if you had the pockets for it, the results were vastly better. I mean, you had Nintendo 64, Jurassic Park graphics, not really, but, you know, that was impressive for a console. But you compare that to something like Quake or, you know, the previews you were seeing for Unreal and things like that, and there was just no comparing. Like, Tomb Raider on Saturn versus Tomb Raider on PC. Like, the PC just absolutely demolished it if you had the right hardware. But that's a big part of it. And Jared, I want you to walk us through this, because the 3D accelerator wars were a thing. And they really, that to me, that's kind of what dominates the conversation about PC gaming in this era.
Yeah, the 3D accelerator wars that were already taking place in consoles at this point, the ones we just talked about, where you've got a, you know, the PlayStation's a 3D-oriented console. The Saturn, at the last minute, was redesigned to be a 3D-oriented console. And 64 designed by, you know, Silicon Graphics to be a 3D-oriented console. But all these innovations had already been taking place on PC for a couple of years.
And don't forget about the Pippin Atmark, also yeah. 3D. Or, yeah.
Oh, yeah, let's not forget about the Pippin, exactly. But what the, you know, what these console developers are doing really is kind of aping, one, they're aping their own arcade development, Sega's 3D boards, but they couldn't bring that technology home in that robust a form, which has cost too much. They're trying to miniaturize it. At the same time, people on PCs are trying to do the same thing. And frankly, because so many of them are trying to do it so many different ways, and it's kind of an open standard all over the world, it's happening very quickly. And by 96, what we have finally in PCs is a genuine, mature expectation landscape that there's going to be some 3D dedicated hardware built into your unit if you're seriously going to be doing gaming on your computer. We have just said, you know what? You're going to buy, at the very least, a hybrid card and put it in your computer if you want to be able to do all this cool 3D shit that everybody's talking about. To help enable that, a lot of things happen. One of the most important is a very, very quiet one. In 1996, Microsoft launches a piece of software called Direct3D. And it's still part of your Windows system today. Indeed, it also continues as a part of the core software for the Xbox. All it does is take the layering out of software interface between Windows and the game. Up till now, you're booting back into DOS, into game mode for an optimized gaming build. This says, no, you've got your Windows 95 machine is where your game takes place. Direct3D, DirectSound, DirectX, all these other things we're creating for which the Xbox is named. We're going to put these into your computer, and now you can program these 3D instructions, hardware and software-wise, as easily at this layer as you can anywhere. There's no reason to boot out of Windows anymore. That turns the TCP/IP stack-equipped Windows into the preferred method for LAN and multiplayer gaming of the highest caliber. And that happens along with the release of, in 1996, Quake, and probably more importantly, Quake's first major mod, Team Fortress. Team Fortress, as we know it today, effectively the game of Team Fortress 2, almost unchanged, was a free Quake mod. And people played it till their eyes bled. And it changed the landscape of gaming forever.
All that blood. Yeah. do you want to talk maybe briefly about what it was like to play online multiplayer before DirectX, like Duengo and things like that?
I don't, because it was awful. I mean, trying to play onto do I want to deal with an IPX stack? Do I want to deal with a TCP/IP stack? What about my drivers for my 2D accelerator, my 3D accelerator, my Windows accelerator, my modem drivers, my Win drivers, if I'm doing anything in Win driver mode, my DOS drivers for DOS mode, and they all have to be updated every week because everybody else is updating too. No, it was a nightmare trying to do it. Even being in the same room with somebody and trying to play Doom was hard before Windows 95.
Yeah, I will say that was actually one of the few advantages that Macs had at the time. Maybe not with dial-up, but with like LAN play.
Apple Talk.
You know, if we wanted to play Marathon 2 or something on LAN in the student labs, it was really easy. Like those computers talked to each other pretty effortlessly, and it was very little trouble to set up a multiplayer session just like that. You know, install Marathon 2 or even the demo, and you're good to go. Not so much with the DOS realm.
I set up an IPX Rise of the Triad LAN in a computer lab about 1993, and it took hours. Doing the same
You're actually still there setting it up.
Yeah. Doing the same thing in 1996 with my with a Windows PC and Direct3D, it was just a matter of logging in to GameSpot or GameSpy. Remember GameSpy when it was just software you used to find other Quake games?
I do.
Log on to GameSpy, press the button, you're in. That's it. And that's what Direct3D did, not just for Quake, but for lots and lots and lots and lots of other games. It made the drivers work instantly. It made them constantly updated. You didn't ever fall behind, and things just plugged and played. And now you're online calling people mean names and blowing them up, and it was a lot of fun. Well, not the mean names. I actually didn't like that part at all, so I played with friends mostly.
I mean, in fairness, that was on Usenet before online multiplayer ever existed.
It was on timeshares back in the 60s. Like, people were just mean on the internet from the get-go.
Yeah, you had Roger Wilco, and you screamed at each other on that. And then 1996,
all the way down.
A little piece of technology called the Voodoo. The Voodoo 3D. Probably the most famous 3D card of all time. It was a dedicated PC 3D gaming card. It did not render 2D. You actually ran a pass-through on your 2D card to even use the thing. And you could link two of them together with a pass-through cable if you wanted one to do vertical and one to do horizontal lines. And yeah, it was a really capable version of what pretty much what a modern 3D card does, just much, much, much simpler. So you had software, hardware, and operating level software, like the actual utilities. All you had the game, the hardware to play the game, and the technology needed to make playing the game instantaneous. And then people's lives disappeared. I remember watching human beings just drop out of college like flies. Because why would you go to class when you can play Quake 20 hours a day with your friends?
So, yes, all that 3D stuff, very exciting, very important. I do want to shift the focus back over to the Macintosh briefly, because it was not punching on the same level as the Windows world. And in fact, I was reminded recently on a post on Blue Sky or something that really, at this point, Apple and the Macintosh only survived because Microsoft wanted to avoid an antitrust accusation and getting broken up for monopolizing the computer industry. So they made a concerted effort to keep Apple alive. I don't know if that was necessarily right around here or if that was a couple of years later once Steve Jobs stepped back in.
It was about now that it really started.
Yeah, Microsoft really... they were like, we need this other platform out here, you know, that's got like 4% market share. Because then we can point to that and say, no, look, Windows doesn't have a monopoly. There's Macintosh. You know, Unix and Linux didn't figure into this at all. BOS did not figure into this at all. But, you know, Macintosh had enough viability that it was like, here we go. You know, this is the competition. We're friends with them, and we're putting a lot of stuff on their system, but they're competition. So anyway, you know, that was good for me because I was in graphic design and publications, and that's really where that tech was centered. Like trying to use a Windows machine for desktop publishing, 1996, no thanks. So, you know, sometimes video games did happen on the Mac. And in 1996, the biggest one, in my opinion, was Marathon Infinity, which was the finale of the Marathon trilogy by Bungie. And it was called Marathon Infinity because it shipped with an amazing suite of development tools. Basically, it was like all the utilities and tools that Bungie used internally to create the game. They just included on the disk under a package called Forge. And you saw that, you know, a decade later with Marathon or Halo 3, they included Forge, but it was much more limited. This was basically like make your own total conversions, and people did. So, you know, that right there kept the Marathon the very small but vital fan community alive. But also Marathon Infinity was really, really cool. It was, you know, the finale of a trilogy, but it was a game that almost made no sense when you played it because the narrative was very esoteric and required you to pay a lot of attention to the terminal text that you found around and kind of put together details. And you would switch to a new chapter and all of a sudden, like, your friends were shooting at you, like your bot characters that had been your allies were killing you, and you would kill the aliens and then realize, no, wait, they're on my side. What's going on here? So it kind of kept Marathon alive for a few years after that because of guys like Hamish Sinclair and the Marathon story page who were like, you know what? We got to figure this out. There's a lot happening here. So it's one of my favorite games of all time, just because it's fantastic, like the pinnacle of 2.5D first-person shooter campaign design. The levels are so intricate and so thoughtfully crafted. They really push the boundaries of what you can do with 2.5D. The story really kind of pushes the limits of what you can do with a linear, or not really that linear, narrative with time loops and things like that. And then it has, you know, all these extra components. It had cooperative play. If you wanted to play co-op through the entire campaign, you could. There were some secrets that you could only find that way. Just a really phenomenal FPS, and kind of like the game that Bungie used as their reputation maker, that and Myth, to get bought out by Microsoft.
Oh man, you got me excited talking about Myth. I played some Myth the Fallen Lords back in the day, but this is the wrong
year. That was 97.
And now that's but yeah, Bungie is Marathon, obviously. I mean, sooner or later, I was not macking around at this period of time, but not much.
You just said you were totally macking the entire time you were looking for colleges.
That's
which
true.
Is a Jared.
That's true. Once I got to college the next year, I got access to a Mac lab, which meant access to Marathon. So that was a pretty good life, because there was no prejudice to be found against that marvelous trilogy. I can tell you that. Those were some beautiful games. And then likewise, playing Myth afterward, multiplayer on those. Multiplayer Myth is just so delightfully mean. It's one of the most sadistic experiences in gaming, and I love it.
So Binge had Duke Nukem 3D on his list of things to talk about. I have not really played that very much, but that is another 2.5D game. That was the origin of the build engine, right?
Yeah. So Duke Nukem 3D, I can't pretend to predict what Binge is going to say about it, but I played a lot of it. It was like very much like Marathon in a 2.5D sense. It was more in that Camp of Doom style game development in a lot of ways. And it was famous for its demo that contained a little bit of light nudity. But the actual shooting and running around were pretty generous on that first stage. And so a lot of people ended up buying or stealing more of it later. And I think that that's a game that maybe benefited as much on the strength of its demo as anything else. Like hey, let's just give just the right amount away. We'll show off the character. We'll show off the stupid attitude. We'll show off something ridiculous. And we'll show a really good shooting stage. And afterwards, like, oh, I would play more of that. And people bought it. It's a solid shooter for the time. I don't know if y'all agree.
It was fine.
I haven't played that much of it. The overall vibe of it did not appeal to me. But I feel like I was probably being reactionary. So I should go back and try it sometime. Poking fun at itself than taking itself seriously.
The first one is very much like that. It's very much like Ash Evil Dead level self-reflection than just glorifying this guy. The shit that came up with afterward can die in a fire.
Looking at you, Gearbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's ask about those magic tricks sometimes. We've talked about consoles. We've talked about computers. I was thinking maybe, Kevin, you could walk us through point 23 on your list, where the twain meet.
That's true. So as far as I could tell, in 1996, this was the first public release of Stella, the Atari 2600 emulator, possibly the earliest non-commercial Atari 2600 emulator, and it's one that still gets updates to this day. It's still very relevant. It's probably the best emulator for the hardware available. I was just really digging into this one and finding some old Usenet posts about it. Like, this was a fairly big deal. I think prior to this point, there were a couple of Activision packs with, like, a built-in emulator that was kind of okay, and that was your option if you wanted to play 2600 games in the mid-90s without digging up some old hardware. Because, like, this was also sort of the time frame when nostalgia for that era of gaming was sort of taking off, that first wave of retro gaming interest. So yeah, Stella hit it a good time in that regard.
This opens a floodgate of doors. I mean, this is, you know, we got Nesticle by the next year, and so INES, and
INES was 96.
Yeah. Oh, was that 96?
Yeah. So I hadn't really thought about this, but when I saw Kevin's mention here, I remembered that when I got back from Prague, this is all coming full circle. The official website for Bungie, I know I've mentioned this before, had a bunch of outbound links, and one of them was to a site called Emulation on the Mac. If you can believe, Bungie was like, yeah, go emulate some games. It's fine. But, you know, that took me there, and I discovered emulation. So after I got back from Prague, I was tinkering with emulators on my dinky-ass all-in-one Macintosh and, playing with a Gravis gamepad, you know, the true experience right there. running through Bionic Commando and Kid Icarus at like 80% speed with all kinds of sound errors. But I was like, man, this is really cool. You know, once they get this working, I can play all these games here on my computer. And it did seem like a revelation. I didn't mess with Stella, but INES, and, you know, there were all those Japanese emulators like Pasofami that were very poorly documented in English and not really fully up to snuff, but they were out there and they were fascinating. And they were just part of this like world of technology that was very intriguing to me, but that I'm too stupid to really understand. So I just kind of tinkered at the surface level. But yeah, 96 was emulation, the beginning.
That's true. There were a few in Japan, some earlier emulators, but they were very fussy if you could even find them.
We've done a whole episode on the early history of emulation, and I couldn't find it with a quick search through our schedule, like the full document of episodes we've published, but I probably just wasn't looking for the right keyword. But somewhere in the archives, there is an episode about the origins of emulation. So check that out if you want to hear more. But 96 was kind of the moment where it sort of crystallized and began trickling out into, I don't know if you could call people like us the mainstream at that point, but, you know, to the wider world of casuals.
Mm-hmm. So I took my VCS to college with me in 97. And we used to play Pong on it mostly. That was mainly what it got used for. It was for the Olympics. But I would use Stella, I know, in 97 to shop for new VCS games on eBay. Hmm. Like, I would download a game on Stella, play it, and if I liked it, then I'd order it on this brand new eBay to have my physical cartridge for my stupid dorm room. I remember that being a...
Yeah, I remember visiting, you know, because I didn't have home internet, I just had like a 386 with no online. I would go to the library with like a stack of floppy disks and download these emulators and like whatever games I could fit on there, and then struggle and fail miserably to get them up and running on my home computer. So I don't think I actually got onto this emulation train until closer to like 98, but yeah.
Having to transfer Stella by floppy would have been awful, because it was significantly bigger than that.
Yeah, there were a few things I just had to, like, leave. Like, well, I can't fit this on a floppy, so I guess I can't get it, but...
Oh, my God.
It was a time.
What, you didn't have zip drives so that you could transfer lots of information and then lose it all when the disk died?
The dream, really, but no such luck.
I was using a zip drive around this point to do Windows 95 installs. Had the operating system ripped onto a zip disk and used it to install.
Man, those high-capacity disk systems were so messed up. Like, I lost an entire semester project on a PsyQuest disk because someone didn't dismount it. They just ejected the disk, and the entire thing was lost. And my professor was like, "Yeah, you should have backed it up." Well, you know, these PsyQuest discs cost like $120. I don't have enough money to buy multiples of these, my guy.
Yeah.
Ah, compassion. Such a great thing.
See, you grew up with a Coleco Adam. You were fully versed in the media willing to just completely kill itself if you don't work with it properly. And even then.
Oh, I was so young and naive.
My dad wrote his doctoral dissertation on a Coleco Adam. Still can't get over that. I cannot believe the capes did not erase his work.
All right, so I feel like we've really talked through sort of the big overarching concepts and movements and trends of video gaming in 1996. So we've got, we can kill another 20 minutes or so to make this like a fully fleshed out podcast. So we can just talk about some of the cool stuff we remember from 1996. One thing, you know, kind of a general topic that I did not mention is that in 1996, there was a little thing established called the Imagine Games Network. It kind of, I believe, timed to coincide with the launch of the Nintendo 64. Those mad bastards registered the domain n64.com right from under Nintendo's noses. So if you went to n64.com, it was the baby version of IGN.
Yeah.
Out there telling you about all the cool stuff on N64. They were really doing Nintendo a service, but I believe Nintendo did eventually come to them and say, "We would actually like this domain. Thank you." So they had to change it to IGN64, and then that became N64, IGN. But in addition to N64.com, there was PSX Power, I believe. And there was a Sega site too. So it was like a trio of websites focused around gaming news. It was a very different world in 1996. The idea of 24-hour internet access and updates did not exist. And they approached the newsroom like you would, you know, like a newspaper, which is to say they filed all their stories at the end of the day. So at like 6 p.m. or so, you'd reload and there would be the day's stories. They didn't trickle out throughout the day. It's hard to imagine websites functioning like that, but that was the structure at the time. And then over time, they started to kind of, you know, disseminate information throughout the day. And now we're in the hell world that we are in now, where there is no freedom from doom scrolling. We are always glued to our devices, but it wasn't like that then. It was check in this evening and you've got your day's news. It was good stuff. But, you know, at the same time, I started buying more magazines like Next Generation Magazine and a couple of others that were kind of focused more on editorial, on kind of looking forward to new tech. It all just seemed so interesting and new and exciting. And IGN was a part of that. I don't know if it was the first game news site. Blues News or Shack News or whatever it was called Sugar Shack back in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They might predate IGN, but
the GameSpy Planets were forming around this time too.
I think they were a little later, weren't they?
Yeah, they were right around
Planet,
now.
Planet Fruit Bat and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Planet Quake formed by 97, I think, by the latest.
Okay, yeah. So the idea of getting your news on the internet about video games did started to take form. And somehow, people could make a living doing that. People, you know, living in the San Francisco Bay Area. I believe the IGN offices were in South San Francisco. So that's not a cheap place to live during the dot-com boom. I guess they all had venture capitalists backing them up. I'm not really sure how it worked, but in any case, it was viable. It was a business, and IGN is still around, and they're one of like three video games websites left.
My understanding is that they got some of that snowball money. And then when that started to run out, right around this time, they had a massive but thoughtful contraction that said, how can we survive on a much lower budget for like 10 years after this? And actually pulled it off. Like that was, they effectively said, yes, we're not going to have this unlimited funding we've had anymore, but we also don't think that we have to close. Like, and they found a kind of a window between that that led to the constant, you know, fiery seat of their pants way of doing business that Games Press has had to kind of function with ever since.
I had forgotten about Snowball, but I think that was later.
Snowball didn't come along and screw them till 2000. But the venture capital money was already coming in by 96.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was 2000 when it all shook out, but this was the beginning of the money coming in and being like, okay, we're going to build something huge now.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I thought this was just cool guys posting news about video games to a website. And it wasn't until like a year or two later that I realized, no, they're actually, this is their jobs. They're getting paid to do this. That's crazy. How is that possible? Very exciting times.
And now you too are paid to talk about video games.
Yes. Thank you, Retronaut subscribers. You're keeping me alive. Anyway, let's talk about some individual games. I have talked a lot, so someone else gets to talk now. Kevin, I think... Okay.
So listen, no, Kevin, right, Jared, I'm very chatty.
I was going to give Kevin a chance to stick up for the other console that was still around that we totally forgot about because it was also an arcade machine and also, Game Boy was just kind of like, oh, this relic from a far gone time.
Yes. So 1996 was the release year for maybe one of the most beautiful 2D games ever produced, Metal Slug for the Neo Geo hardware. This first one, I feel like in a lot of ways is probably the peak of the series. Like they got so much right out the gate. You're just two little guys, very like cartoony, you know, plowing your way through a horde of vaguely Nazi-looking enemy soldiers. And there's not, like, a lot of weird science fiction or fantasy elements in this one like they would introduce in the later Metal Slug games. Like, there's no zombies or mummies or aliens.
Oh, so the squid aliens were not in the original?
I think they show up in 3.
Hmm, okay.
But,
to me, they're just baked into the fabric of... I mixed my metaphors there.
Yeah, they like the, I feel like the elements of the first like three or so games really kind of get considered like, yes, this is Metal Slug. But sort of the key factor here is that your little guys can jump in these ridiculous little like, I don't know, they're very squat and silly looking tanks called the Metal Slug, and you can sort of drive them around and blow stuff up. Like, if I remember, this was produced by former IREM staffers who worked on In the Hunt. And if you've ever seen In the Hunt, you can see the visual cues between the two. And they're
this one was developed by NASCA, right?
Yes. And
okay. And then NASCA was acquired by SNK?
Yeah, that SNK scooped them up. And, you know, this, if I remember, this was produced originally as a tank game, and then they decided, after, like, partway through development to also have you get out of the tank and run around as a person on foot.
Ah, so you got that Sophia the Third element going on there. Metal
Slug. Although the tank is more like Dominion Tank Police.
Visual design, yeah.
It was on my list too, and because it's so darn, for me, it's just a matter of walking around Japan. To this day, the odds are if you're standing somewhere in Tokyo, you're within 50 yards of a semi-broken Metal Slug machine. Like it's there. You might not see it, but it's behind a wall or above you or something. It's watching you.
Yeah.
And the ubiquity of this wonderful, the ubiquity of this wonderful, wonderful game. It made it. It was everywhere here. It's everywhere there. And I couldn't figure it out for the longest time. When I was a kid, I loved it. I thought it was beautiful, but I didn't understand how anything that cute could die with one hit. So I kept trying to play it like I had a life bar instead of playing Contra, just because I was too cute to die that fast. And then I would get frustrated when I'd be destroyed. And I'd be like, but no, I should bounce off like a cotton character or something. And once I got my head around that funnel, I was like, well, this is the best fucking thing ever. And I'm going to play all of these and still do. And I think X and 3 are just, I hope that I die playing Metal Slug X. That sounds like a great day.
See, I feel like it peaked at 2, but X is also very good.
Yeah, I like X because it's 2, but it runs. I mean, I think 2, in terms of design, is great. It just chugs so much.
Yeah, I just didn't. I feel like X didn't have as tight a level design as 2.
It doesn't. You're correct.
You gotta find the Slug 2 mod that has the speed fixes.
That's okay, just like finding the correct Pac-Man mod with the speed up chip. But the 1-bit speed up, not the button based speed up, which screws up the pacing of the game.
So this is Metal Slug 2 is the reason they created the Hyper Neo Geo 64, right? So they could have the power to run Metal Slug unadulterated.
Obviously.
That must be it. Yeah. Clearly. And that was a huge success that we'll talk about in our Years in Review for 1997. Because who doesn't love the Hyper Neo Geo 64?
It had at least 3 good games, and no one played them.
Really?
A lot of video games are run right, jump up, and shoot mans. And this is among the best of the run right, jump up, and shoot mans genre. Big fan.
There's no mans I'd rather shoot than the bad guys in Metal Slug. Okay, so Metal Slug, gorgeous game. Let's see if I can come up with a cool segue from that. Oh, actually, Jared, you were going to talk about Metal Slug, but also you had something else you wanted to wrap in there that's completely unrelated. I'm not sure why you put those together, but now's your chance. We can segue awkwardly.
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about that. Yeah, I just put them both in there because they were the beginning of very big things. That's all. Metal Slug starts this year, and Evil got residential this year for the first time. And I do think when we're talking about the PlayStation and 3D, that's a very, very early use case of somebody figuring out how to use 3D effectively. Yes, we had Mario jumping through cool little worlds. Yes, we had Lara hiding through tombs. But those pre-rendered 3D backgrounds, the tank controls, the narrow hallways, they use those tools to the spookiest possible conclusion and scared the living hell out of a lot of us. I unashamedly dropped my controller in terror at least twice on my first trip of the way through Resident Evil. And I think it's a wonderful
There are thing. Worse things to drop in terror, so...
Mm-hmm. Is it the first survival horror game? No, it's not, but it's probably the first really effective one.
I mean, the entire structure and style of Resident Evil was lifted wholesale from Infogrames' Alone in the Dark, but it's so much more compelling, cinematic, detailed, immersive, even the hokey-ass narrative and just scenery-chewing dialogue and line readings are just, you know, perfect. It just feels like a bad horror movie that you can play.
Yeah. Exactly. You nail it. And that's a good thing. And we didn't really have that in video games before then. And now we do. Now we can fairly... It's kind of miraculous that we got like several pretty good ones of these. And then they did the thing where they fell off a cliff. But now we're like, oh, wait, they make good ones again. Yay! That's mm-hmm. been a pretty nice rediscovery here in these 2020s, these dark times. RE2 and 3 turning out to be really good was wonderful. RE4, likewise.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that Resident Evil, like, not only did it do really well, it basically is the game that saved Capcom from, you know, crashing and burning like a bunch of other game developers did in the mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah. Gave him time to invent Monster Hunter.
Yeah, gave him time to find something else to run into the ground, as is their wont.
So do you want to talk about Street Fighter Alpha 2, Kevin?
Yeah, speaking of things that are crashing and burning. So Street Fighter Alpha 2.
Although, no, Street Fighter Alpha 2 rules.
It is a really good game. I would consider it the best of Capcom's, like, post-Street Fighter 2 fighting game works in the mid-90s, or in the 90s period.
Wow, is that a diss against Third Strike?
I will diss Third Strike every opportunity I get, and that's...
But the memes.
The memes.
Don't you love parrying, Kevin?
Oh man, I hate parrying so much. But you know, Alpha 2 has its own memes, if you're an old enough person to remember them. You know, like the earliest... I would feel like the earliest high-profile fighting game tournaments in the U.S. were built around Alpha 2. And there are some recollections online that I remember reading about, like, the finals for at least one of them, where it basically came down to someone picking Rose and just doing her crouch strong over and over again, and the other person, like, couldn't get around it. It's a really funny game. It feels like more than, I'd say, like, Alpha 3 or the Street Fighter 3 games. It feels like an evolution of what they were doing with Street Fighter 2. The custom combos are completely absurd and overpowered. The alpha counters are completely absurd and overpowered. But, like, it all just kind of gels in a way that really works really well. It's really fun. I do genuinely like this game a lot. It had a great Super NES port. I'm just throwing it out there.
A technological marvel. It's unbelievable they managed that. Yes. I mean, it has load times. So, like, if you've got load times on your Super NES cartridge, you know something's up. But... you know, it was a miraculous port, and I have to say, like, it's hard to put yourself back into the mindset of the mid-90s and how we related to Street Fighter 2, because Street Fighter 2 came out and there were, like, 1,000 variants, both legal and not, and by the time Super Street Fighter came out, it was like, okay, guys, it's been several years. Can you really not count to three? And then they followed that with Alpha, and, you know... I remember seeing Alpha and just thinking, this isn't what I want. I mean, it's cartoonish, I guess. That's fine. But Street Fighter 2, Alpha 2, there was just something about it. I think the huge cast of characters, I think this was the game where they kind of looked to SNK and King of Fighters and said, you know what? We need a little of that juju. We need some of that magic. So they kind of went for more stylized characters, more flamboyant, outrageous control schemes and combo inputs that weren't just the typical Street Fighter type. You know, giving you characters like Rose, who had variable styles, and also just a sense of humor. You know, this is the game that introduced Sakura, the schoolgirl who is shockingly a very good fighter, but also kind of a goofball. And then you have Dan Hibiki, who is just a goofball and also not a good fighter. You had, you know, a lot of guys from who had shown up in the original Street Fighter or in Final Fight and were kind of reinvented to be really cool, like Rolento or Adon. It just had a really great vibe about it. It just felt energetic and lively. You know, the special effects were really cool. It just made, you know, when you landed a great combo and you got the flashing effects, it just felt like you'd done something significant, but it didn't get in the way of the action. And again,
I really loved
the Super NES port, like, that got a lot of play in my the house I was renting with some roommates in college.
I loved that just a week ago or so, we got 30 years of relevance on this when I saw multiple references online to Dan Hibiki beating up Andrew Tate.
At that, he could, breaking his that jaw.
That fight last week, Dan Hibiki had broken Andrew Tate's jaw. And I don't know if that was the pink gloves or if that was the fact that the person was a fairly inexperienced fighter, but well done, Dan Hibiki of the real world.
But people were pointing out that was like straight up Dudley moves, actually.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Well observed, that Dudley.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's kind of beautiful. But yeah, y'all are right. It's a hell of a game. I dig it myself and played a hell of a lot of it. I don't know if I'm right about this, so if I'm wrong, just don't listen. But I believe I remember reading this year that some amateur programmer took it upon themselves to go back and fight with the loading parts of Street Fighter Alpha 2 for Super Nintendo, and that they had managed to remove the loading segments from the game and make it function straight on without them, which I thought was an interesting thing.
Well, you know, that was all due to compression. So I think if you put the game on a big enough ROM chip, like a virtual ROM, then it's not really an issue. It's just those ROM chips didn't exist at the time, and certainly not, you know, in a manner that would be affordable for a normal human. So
I don't know enough about the technical end of it, so I'm just going to trust you on this. But yeah,
that's my assumption. Maybe I'm wrong. Correct me in the comments, folks.
I'm glad you brought up Sakura because she was like, I feel like the second most popular Street Fighter character for probably a good 15 or 20 years almost, right after Chun-Li for quite a while, just based off of how much fun she was in Alpha 2 and Alpha 3 and just her general like goofy design and everything.
Yeah, as a man who is not very tall and does not have a very big build, like I don't like playing as big, beefy characters. I don't know. Like, I guess you want to see a little of yourself in a video game. And there's nothing escapist about playing someone like Sagat or Zangief for me. But I do enjoy, like, the fast, nimble characters, the smaller ones, and they tend to be women. So, yeah, I played a lot of Chun-Li, and I played a lot of Sakura. Like, the idea, just the entire idea of Sakura. Here is, you know, all these crazy fighting game characters from around the world. They're martial arts experts. And then there's just, you know, the schoolgirl who decides, I'm going to jump in and have a good time. And she's kind of ridiculous. And like I said, kind of clumsy, but also just, it was just so outlandish and weird at the time, at least, to see a game released in America where you had that particular Japanese media trope, which did not appear very often. It was like, you know, around the same time we got Project Echo localized over here. So it was kind of, you know, that whole like, here are teenage girls that have crazy powers and we don't know why, but have fun. I don't know. That just, it amused me. And so I played as her a lot. I also played a lot as Dan because he's such a goofball and he's terrible. And I felt good about losing as him. When you lose as someone like Adon, who's like, unequivocally awesome, you feel like a dork. You're like, oh man, I suck too much to be playing this. But when you lose as Dan, you're like, well, yeah, of course I lost as Dan. He's meant to lose. So Dan's good justification for me not being a very good fighting game character player.
Yeah. And first game you could play as Akuma without putting in a code. I'm sure someone was very excited about that.
Someone.
Yeah. You know,
what if Ryu, but an edgelord?
And speaking of, like, you know, girl stuff, if you permit me to go on to the next item real quick.
Please do.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring up the top-selling computer game of 1996 and the top-selling girls game, Barbie Fashion Designer. It's outsold Quake and Doom in its first year. Like, I think it ended up doing, like, over a million units or something like that. There's a great, like, history of it that Rachel Simone Weil put together a while back, and there's a good, like, article, if you don't want to listen to that, by Nicole Carpenter on Polygon still. But this was basically taking the old conceit that had been around for decades at that point of, like, cutting out paper outfits for your Barbie dolls, and the idea was like, well, Can we come up with a way where you would be able to print up your own fabric designs on a computer program? And, you know, Mattel was receptive to it. They'd been burned by, like, the Intellivision a decade earlier. So they were, like, trying to keep it a little quiet that they were working on a computer game. But, yeah, they got this together, and it not only worked really well, it sold really well. And, like, this was, I think, really introduced them into the there's a market segment for women and girls for computers. I believe it's in the Video Game Hall of Fame now at the Strong Museum of Play. It's a very fascinating little thing that completely missed me by as someone who did not have a very good computer and did not have Barbie dolls. But
girls using computers sounds fishy to me. Not so sure about that.
Yeah, super cool. Super worth noting for 1996.
Yeah, I feel like
Barbie's fashion designer.
I feel like girls showed up a lot in video game marketing in like the 70s and early 80s and just kind of gradually were pushed out. You know, they'd show up as like scenery in advertisements, but really video games were meant to be for boys. And yeah, anything that can push back against that is welcome. And, you know, in a few years later, we got The Sims, which was very much a game that appealed to all people of all genders and all ages. And I think did a lot to sort of break the idea that only boys can play video games. So, you know, cheers to Barbie fashion designer.
Amen.
Knowing that it outsold Quake, I'm wondering, were there any Barbie total conversions for Quake made around this time? Because would have been the juggernaut.
Oh my gosh.
That's what we need to know.
Wow.
And actually, let me segue into my next topic as we kind of wind down here. Another game that was very much like girls are cool in a different way than Sakura or Barbie, and that was Tomb Raider, a game that was basically 3D Prince of Persia as Indiana Jones. And at some point, the designers at Core said, you know what? This should be a woman. Not necessarily for the most noble reasons. They were going to be looking at someone's backside in 3D for hours. So they said, let's make it a lady's backside. Okay, well, so that's kind of the origin of Lara Croft. But sorry, British people, Lara Croft. But nevertheless, they did release a game where you play as a woman the entire time. She's got all kinds of guns and other explosive devices. She kills things. She explores things. She outwits death traps. She solves puzzles. She, at some point, let's see, in the first game, she like stops ancient Egyptian mummies from coming back to life and taking over the world. And the entire time she is a lady, and at no point outside of the intro where there's a dude talking to her in a sexist way, does the fact that she is a woman create an impediment, create an issue of any sort? She's just out there, an earnest adventurer, kicking ass like any video game hero could. And as much as boys liked looking at Lara Croft's backside, a lot of women played Tomb Raider and played a game that was much more, let's say, chewy and combat-oriented than you would necessarily expect from marketing and from demographic studies to appeal to women. But they liked Lara, and she became a huge character, like the big breakout star of the 90s, really, in terms of video games. You know, she became a pop culture sensation, starring in U2 concerts. It got kind of weird. Douglas Copeland wrote books about her. After, you know, this is follow up to Microsurfs and J-Pod and Gen X or Generation X. It was a wild time, but Tomb Raider, the game, was the thing that launched Lara Croft into superstardom and, you know, defied a lot of preconceptions and stereotypes about video games and about the people who play them. So also a really good game. They're redoing the original, I think, now, and like some sort of anniversary edition, which will be the second time they've redone the original game. I don't know if it will be as compellingly lonely and have that sort of Metroid-like sense of isolation. where you are also another lady playing on her own, although you don't get to do that in the modern Metroids. Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. Just rambling like an old man.
I played this on PC in 96, and it was, from a technical perspective, it was mind-blowing. Even though you could see things like the chessboard layout and all that, it didn't matter. You're just like, oh, okay, that's a clever trick.
You needed to kind of feel that to maneuver through the world, because it was built, like her movement was built around the chessboard.
Yeah, once you figured that out, you were great. Like, it was, oh, okay, this is that dinosaur level at the beginning? Just that first stage, like wandering around all by yourself, and then, oh, it's lonely, and there's wolves, and it's kind of dead. Holy shit, dinosaur! You know, it was great.
There's a T-Rex. Oh, boy, gotta shoot it with my handguns till it dies.
Gotta make this thing extinct for real.
Yeah, and it was, but it was lovely. The character was everything. And, of course, it was handled grotesquely by lots of teenage boys, the famous nude codes and whatnot that did or didn't exist that people were forever trying to load on the school computers and share with one another, I remember. But she did come to, I really wish she'd been better treated the time she's been brought back. I do feel they've fumbled it every time. Even the more popular revivals have not treated the character particularly well. The games are sometimes good, but Lara herself as a representative of video games has been ill-treated by the stewards of her legacy, and it does trouble me.
Yeah, I mean,
in a new and exciting way every time.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of daddy trauma in just about every single media adaptation.
She's made because men made her broken. Like, that's the idea. And that's not good enough for this person.
Yeah, the Angelina Jolie movies were kind of like that. The Alicia Vikander movie had that. The Hayley Atwell cartoon is very much like that, to the point that it's kind of distracting and unwatchable. Just like, let Lara be out there exploring and, you know, driving animals to extinction because she's a cool lady who likes to explore and kill stuff. Like, that can be motivation. It's okay. She doesn't have to have trauma because of her dad. It's fine.
Yeah, I'd like for her just as once to come across as somebody who has more in common with Carmen Sandiego than some kind of traumatized assault victim.
She started that way for sure.
Yeah, like she had that background where like her parents did stuff and they died and she had to survive in the wilderness. You know, very, very Hatchet oriented, if you ever read that book. But yeah, at some point someone decided that this should really be the focus rather than just like the lore of the character that you could miss entirely if you didn't read the book that came with the game.
This is now the Ron Paulson Hatchet podcast. And we'll be talking about the various things hunted along the side of the lake now.
All right, Kevin. Oh, no, sorry. Jared, do you want to talk about one last game before we wrap?
I could. I think we've covered most of the essentials. But sure, what do we got here? I mean, you know, we already talked about Mario 64 a little. That's kind of important. But I'm just going to talk about my favorite game of this year, which is Civ 2. And we all know why Civ's real good and how many things have changed. Civ 2 changed most of the broken things about Civ and made them work and created, in my opinion, the most coherent version of the game that's ever existed. Everything after Civ 2, it becomes less a scale war game and more a society simulator, which I think works to the detriment of the design of the first two games. I think they were designed to be war games, and 2 works best as that. It's a very pure expression of the 4X expansionist-oriented war game. 3 and 5, 6, 7, they're all fine. I love them. But 2 is the most fun by a long shot. Because what you're trying to accomplish in terms of what it takes to win and what you're trying to accomplish in terms of the tools available are better synchronized in 2 than in any other version before or since. you have the tools to, you want to go become a, you want to break down your entire 300-year-old democracy and transform it into a fundamentalist empire to overrun your neighbors and betray everything that, you can do that in two. It's much harder to do in the other games.
Let's not do that one. Let's make friends with everyone. Let's all be pals. Video game pals.
I'm sitting up in Canada. She's just shivering right now, believe me.
Just don't piss off Gandhi.
I've heard that the Gandhi buffer overrun bug is kind of an urban legend.
That's my understanding, but it's still really funny.
It is really funny.
I can't speak to why it happens. I know that anecdotally, Gandhi in those first couple of games just loves to come after you. I have no idea why, but the dude is bloodthirsty.
I think it's because he's a computer character and not an accurate representation of a human.
That sounds about right.
Like all AI, really.
Yeah.
Exactly. So let's see. Okay, Civ 2. Kevin, is there any one last thing you want to talk about?
So my last item was Wayne Gretzky's 3D Hockey, which is not maybe the most noteworthy game, but I remember playing quite a lot of it on the N64. It was like the first really big, I'd say, four-player game on that hardware. And it's also a really good arcade game. This is basically sort of, what if NBA Jam used polygons and was also hockey? Like, it's very silly, it's very fast-paced, very cartoonish in how it does things. Like, sometimes the goalie will turn into a brick wall, sometimes the puck is literally on fire. They had a lot of fun with it. This was like, I think, was this one Atari Games, or was this Midway? I don't know.
They were the same at that point.
Yeah, well, then weren't there they? You go.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's from those developers, and it has a lot of those hallmarks of their, you know, their games. Just a lot of arcade action. Yeah, I think this one holds up pretty well. Like, the computer is not a very good opponent, but you get a few people together, you can have a great time with it.
I covered that a few years ago on N64 Works, and because I am not good at sport, it was probably not a very good video, but in my defense, I don't care. Finally, I'm going to wrap it up just by mentioning 1996, was kind of a breakout, beginning of a breakout year for the PlayStation. And one of the things that PlayStation gave us that Nintendo consoles had not given us was the first Shin Megami Tensei game. Now, this is not technically true. Technically, Virtual Boy gave us Jak Brothers, a twin stick shooter, maze shooter starring the Jacks, you know, Jack Frost, Jack the Ripper. But I mean, come on, that wasn't really a Persona game or a Shin Megami Tensei game. Revelations Persona was, even though technically in Japan it was Megami Ibun Roku, not Shin Megami Tensei. I don't care. I keep trying to emphasize this point. I don't care. This was, for all intents and purposes, the first Mega Ten game. It took nearly a decade for this very popular RPG series to finally make its way to the US. And that's probably because, for example, Shin Megami Tensei 2 opens with the character, the player, in a maze, a 3D maze, and you walk through it, and there's Jesus on a crucifix talking to you. That's kind of, you know, you can see where Nintendo would be like, eh, maybe not. But, you know, on PlayStation, standards and moral panics kind of subsided, and Sony said, we're aiming for an older audience. We don't care quite so much what the PTA says. And also, you know, there was a growing interest in Japanese imports with the rise of anime and manga in America, and a growing, you know, kind of surging interest in role-playing games that would really take off the next year with Final Fantasy VII. So Megaten Persona was one of the first significant RPGs of that generation to be released in the US, and kind of set the tone, set the stage for everything that was to come that generation. And now the Persona series is celebrating its 30th anniversary, and I would say is probably, depending on what you consider console RPGs at this point, maybe like the second most popular RPG series in the US after Final Fantasy. You know, maybe not, but close enough. Do you consider Dark Souls and the Souls-likes of From Software to be RPGs? Maybe, maybe not. It's all semantic and pedantic, and once again, I don't care. The point is, Persona made its debut in America, 1996, and we haven't gotten every game since then, but most of them, and it's been very popular and done well for itself. So I'm glad Atlus finally took a chance and said, let's go for it and give the American kids a real RPG and not just a strange twin-stick shooter on a system that no one's going to buy. Anyway, that's 1996, at least some of the highlights and kind of the top-level picture. This was Retronauts talking about 1996, and I believe this is a patron-exclusive episode, so I don't have to go through the promotional spiel because you know the details already. You are supporting us. You believe in us. You wanted to hear this episode. You paid to hear this episode, and for that, we are grateful. Thank you for your contributions, for your subscriptions, for your support. We will continue to make great podcasts in the year 2026, and you will feel good about supporting us. That is our guarantee to you, the Retronauts listener. You've got our six, we've got your six. We're right on each other's butts. What can I say? That sounded bad. Guys, please tell us where we can find you on the internet. Jared, where can we find you on the internet? We don't have to go to Canada to find you. You're on the internet.
Nah, just go to ye old search engine, if those still exist, and look for the Top 100 Games Podcast. You'll find me. The Top 100 Games Podcast with Jared Petty, which is the dumb show, where I just have different guests on to talk about video games they love, and that's really all it is. There's not a lot of virtue to it unless you enjoy hearing pleasant people pining for days of old and talking about the virtues of a toy that brought them joy in their lives. And if you're into that, then yeah, probably want to listen to it. So that's where to find me.
Boy, I can't imagine anything worse than listening to good people talk about good things. That sounds awful.
It is terrible. I also occasionally work for Other Ocean here in Cornwall. And we just announced Scrap Daddies, which is a brand new game coming out in early access pretty soon. There's an open and closed beta. So if you want to Google Scrap Daddies in incognito mode, go for that and see what you can find.
Kevin, yourself?
You can find me on Blue Sky at atariarchive.org. That's also my website, which I update periodically. I also have a YouTube series that I update more or less monthly called Atari Archive, where I'm going through the 2600 library chronologically with the occasional side excursions into television and whatever other topic springs to mind. So you can find me on those things, and I have a book out through Limited Run Games called Atari Archive Volume 1 that I also, as the author, highly recommend.
That's my favorite book on Atari that I've ever read.
Thank you.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on social media, Blue Sky, as Jay Parrish. You can find me doing things at Limited Run Games, such as publishing Kevin's book and my own book, an upcoming book. Actually, that's coming through Dark Horse through a partnership with Limited Run called Metroidvania, The First Decade. That's out in March. It's going to be great. In the meantime, I have lots of other books you can find at limitedrungames.com. Hooray. And then, of course, I've got my YouTube series that most of my books are based on called, let's just call it NES Works for now, because that's what I'm focusing on. Just look for my name, Jeremy Parrish, only one R in Parrish, because I'm cool and I don't need extra R's to get the point across. Anyway, this has been it for our Years in Review. We'll be back again in a year with more of these. But in the meantime, we've got something like, 75 podcasts for your ears. So please look forward to those in the coming year. And in the meantime, please look back and enjoy the great things of years past.